This is a summary of The Body Keeps the Score by Bessele van der Kolk, MD by bestbookbriefings.com. The Body Keeps the Score. Brain, Mind and Body in the Healing of Trauma. By Bessele van der Kolk, MD. Rediscovering Trauma. Humans are a resilient species, but traumatic experiences have a way of leaving indelible marks on our minds, our emotions, and even on our bodies. Trauma affects not only the ones who directly experience it, but also the people around them. Families of soldiers returning home from combat are frightened with their rage and emotional unavailability. The spouses of those who suffer from PTSD tend to become depressed, and the children of depressed parents are at risk of growing up insecure and anxious. Exposure to family violence as a child also makes it difficult to establish stable, trusting relationships as an adult. The birth of three new branches of psychiatric science has led to an explosion of knowledge about the effects of psychological trauma and abuse, namely, neuroscience, developmental psychopathology, and interpersonal neurobiology. Research from these new disciplines reveals that trauma results in a recalibration of the brain's alarm system, which increases the production of stress hormones and affects the system it uses to filter out relevant information. This explains why traumatized individuals find it difficult to engage with their day-to-day lives, and why they have so much trouble learning from their experiences. We now know that these behaviors are not the result of a moral failing or signs of lack of willpower or character; rather, they are caused by physical changes in the brain. This new knowledge about the underlying processes of trauma has opened up new ways to halt or even reverse the damage. There are three new fundamental methods that employ the brain's natural resilience to help survivors move on with their lives, of which most people will require a combination of. The first method is processing the memories of trauma by talking through it and allowing the person to understand what is going on within them. The second method is by taking medicine that will shut down inappropriate alarm reactions. The third method is by allowing the body to have experiences that profoundly contradict the helplessness, rage, or collapse that result from trauma. This is the work that the author dedicated his life to, with the support of his colleagues and students at the Trauma Center, which he founded 3 decades ago. Together, they have treated thousands of traumatized children and adults, victims of child abuse, natural disasters, wars, accidents, and more. This book serves as both a guide and an invitation to facing the reality of trauma. As a society, we must commit ourselves to exploring how best to treat it and to use every means at our disposal to prevent it from happening in the first place. The reorganization of perception. Despite our willingness to move beyond trauma, the part of our brain that is responsible for ensuring our survival is not very good at denial. Any traumatic experience has a chance of reactivating at the slightest hint of danger, even long after it has already passed. Survivors of trauma often fear that they have no control, that they are damaged to the core and beyond redemption. The author conducted a study at the Veterans Affairs, which started as research about nightmares but ended up exploring how trauma changes people's perceptions and imagination. Participants at the study were given Rorschach tests, which require objective responses that are almost impossible to fake. The Rorschach test observes how people construct a mental image from the meaningless visual stimulus of blots of ink on a piece of paper. In turn, this provides researchers with a unique insight into their subjects' minds. Bill, a former medic who had seen heavy action in Vietnam, was the first person enrolled in the nightmare study. He had been doing fine after his discharge until he and his wife had their first child. One day, Bill stayed home to take care of the baby, but when the baby started to cry, he suddenly found himself flooded with horrific images of dying children in Vietnam. Panicked, Bill went to the VA, describing how he couldn't stop hearing babies crying and seeing the images of burned and bloody children's faces. Upon taking the Rorschach test, Bill exclaimed in horror that the second card was a child he saw blown up in Vietnam, from the charred flesh to the blood. The second Rorschach card is the first card that contains color, which often elicits a so-called color shock response. In that moment, Bill was seeing the same images, smelling the same smells, and feeling the same physical sensations he had felt during the original event 10 years ago. In a way, flashbacks might be worse than the actual traumatic experience. You never know when they will come up again, or if they will ever stop. When the Rorschach test was given to 21 other veterans, 16 of them reacted as if they were experiencing a wartime trauma. None of them mentioned fluttering butterflies, men on motorcycles, or any of the other ordinary, sometimes bizarre images that most people see. The responses of the other five were even more alarming. They went blank. "This is just a bunch of ink," one of them observed. This was true, of course, but the normal human response to ambiguous stimuli is to use imagination to create meaning. The results of the Rorschach tests proved that traumatized people tend to impose their trauma on everything around them and have trouble decoding it. They showed that trauma affects the imagination and causes a loss of mental flexibility, as the participants simply kept replaying the old reel over and over. Imagination is critical to the quality of our lives. It enables us to break out of our routine existence and gives us the ability to envision new possibilities. Without imagination, there is no hope, no chance to envision a better future, and no goal to reach. Addicted to trauma. During their therapy groups with Vietnam combat veterans, the author was astonished to see how many of them came to life when they talked about their wartime experiences. They even complained about a vague sense of emptiness and boredom when they weren't angry, stressed, or in danger. How could these people have a preference for painful situations? In the 1970s, Richard Solomon of the University of Pennsylvania discovered that the body has the ability to adjust to stimuli. Fear and aversion can be transformed into pleasure. Activities like marathon running or parachute jumping, which initially cause discomfort and even terror, can eventually become very enjoyable. Solomon hypothesized that endorphins, the morphine-like chemicals that the brain secretes in response to stress, plays a role. But were these observations relevant to people with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder? To test this, the author and his colleagues asked 8 combat veterans to take a standard pain test while watching scenes from a number of movies. They measured how long the veterans could keep their right hands in a bucket of ice water while watching a clip from a violent movie, Platoon, and a peaceful movie. 7 of the 8 veterans kept their hands in the painfully cold water 30% longer during the violent movie. The amount of analgesia produced by watching 15 minutes of a combat movie was equivalent to 8 milligrams of morphine, almost the same dose a person would receive in an emergency room. Their conclusion was that strong emotions can block pain as a result of the release of morphine-like substances created in the brain. This suggests that for many traumatized people, re-exposure to stress might provide a relief from anxiety. The triumph of pharmacology. It is a broadly accepted belief that mental illness is caused primarily by chemical imbalances in the brain that can only be corrected by specific drugs. In many countries, drugs have supplanted therapy. However, after conducting numerous studies of PTSD medication, the author discovered that psychiatric medication deflects attention from the mental illness's underlying issues. Consider antidepressants. If they were as effective as widely believed, depression should by now have become a minor issue in our society. Instead, the number of people being treated for depression has tripled, with 500,000 children in the United States currently prescribed for antipsychotic drugs. These medications are used to make abused and neglected children more compliant. In 2008, 19,045 children age 5 and under were prescribed antipsychotics through Medicaid. One study found that 12.4% of children in foster care received antipsychotics, compared with 1.4% of Medicaid-eligible children in general. While these medications make children more manageable and less aggressive, they also undermine motivation, play, and curiosity, which are indispensable for the process of maturing into a well-functioning and contributing member of society. There is a modern epidemic of drug overdoses involving psychiatric and pain medications. Practitioners who explore treatments are marginalized as alternative practitioners. Studies of non-drug treatments are rarely funded. The fact that we can actually change our own physiology and inner equilibrium by means other than drugs is rarely considered. Adaptation or disease? The brain disease model overlooks 4 fundamental truths. 1. Our ability to destroy one another is matched by our ability to heal one another. Restoring relationships and community is central to restoring our well-being. 2. Language gives us the power to change ourselves and others by communicating our experiences, helping us define our world and find a common sense of meaning. 3. We have the ability to regulate our own physiology, including some so-called involuntary functions of the body and brain, through such basic activities as breathing, moving, and touching. 4. We can change social conditions to create environments in which children and adults can feel safe and thrive. When we ignore these essential aspects of humanity, we deprive people of ways to heal from trauma and restore their autonomy. Being a patient, rather than a participant in one's healing process, separates suffering people from their community and alienates them from their inner selves.
Paths to recovery. Owning yourself. Trauma robs you of the feeling of self-leadership.
The challenge of recovery is in regaining ownership of your body and your mind, which means feeling free to know what you know and to feel what you feel without becoming overwhelmed or ashamed.
In order to regain control over yourself, you need to revisit the trauma.
The first order of business is to find ways to cope with feeling overwhelmed by the sensations and emotions associated with the past pain. The engines of post-traumatic reactions are located in the emotional part of the brain. In contrast with the rational brain, which expresses itself in thoughts, the emotional brain manifests itself in physical reactions, gut-wrenching sensations, heart pounding, breathing becoming fast and shallow, etc. If we want to change the post-traumatic reactions, we have to perform limbic system therapy, repairing faulty alarm systems and restoring the emotional brain to the role of a quiet presence in the background.
Accessing the emotional brain. Trauma is much more than a story about something that happened long ago.
The emotions and physical sensations that were imprinted during the trauma are experienced not as memories but as disruptive physical reactions. Neuroscience research shows that the only way we can change this is by becoming aware of our inner experience and befriending it.
Befriending the emotional brain.
1. Dealing with hyperarousal. If we try to figure out how emotions are registered in the body, we will find that 80% of the fibers in our brain are connected to our internal organs. This means that we can directly train our arousal system by the way we breathe, chant, and move, a principle that has been utilized for millennia in countries like China and India. In research supported by the National Institutes of Health, the author and his colleagues have shown that 10 weeks of yoga practice markedly reduced the PTSD symptoms of patients who failed to respond to any other treatment. Learning how to breathe calmly and remaining in a state of relative physical relaxation, even while accessing painful and horrifying memories, is an essential tool for recovery. When you deliberately take a few slow, deep breaths, you will notice the effects of the parasympathetic brake on your arousal. The more you stay focused on your breathing, the calmer you will be, particularly if you pay attention until the very end of your exhalation, and then wait a moment before you inhale again.
2. Practicing mindfulness. Self-awareness is at the core of recovery.
Simply noticing our anxiety immediately helps us shift our perspective, which opens up new options apart from our automatic reactions.
Traumatized people are often afraid of their emotions.
In order to change this, you need to open yourself to your inner experience.
The first step is to allow your mind to focus on your sensations. Notice how your physical sensations are transient and respond to slight shifts in body position, breathing, and thinking.
Once you pay attention to your physical sensations, the next step is to label them, like when I feel anxious, I feel a crushing sensation in my chest. In cases like these, the therapist may say to a patient, "Focus on that sensation and see how it changes when you take a deep breath out, or when you tap your chest just below your collarbone, or when you allow yourself to cry." Practicing mindfulness calms down the sympathetic nervous system, so that you are less likely to be thrown into fight or flight mode. Learning to observe and tolerate your physical reactions is a prerequisite for safely revisiting the past. If you cannot tolerate what you are feeling right now, opening up the past will only worsen the misery and re-traumatize you. Jon Kabat-Zinn, a pioneer in mind-body medicine, founded the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, MBSR, program at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center in 1979, and his method has been thoroughly studied ever since. He describes mindfulness as taking the scattered and reactive energies of your mind and focusing them into a coherent source of energy for living, for problem solving, for healing.
3. Relationships. Studies have shown that a good support network is the most powerful protection shield against trauma.
Nothing calms us down like the reassuring voice or the firm embrace of someone we trust. Frightened adults respond to the same comforts as terrified children, gentle holding and rocking and the assurance that somebody bigger and stronger is taking care of things.
Survivors after an acute trauma usually require the presence of familiar faces and voices. It is critical to communicate with loved ones and reunite with them in a place that feels safe.
Studies conducted during World War II showed that children who lived in London during the Blitz and were sent away to the countryside for protection fared much worse than the children who remained with their parents,
despite enduring nights in bomb shelters and seeing frightening images of ravaged buildings and people. Getting hurt by someone you love presents a real challenge for recovery. In such cases, you fear opening up to new people, becoming preoccupied with not getting hurt again. You may even try to hurt them before they have a chance to hurt you. But once you gather the courage to face your inner self, you will find that you need help to do so. You need to find someone you can trust to hold your feelings and help you listen to the painful messages from your emotional brain. You need a guide who can handle you at your darkest. 5. Taking action. Back in 1893, Pierre Janet, the first great explorer of trauma, wrote about the pleasure of completed action. When patients physically experience what it would have felt like to fight back or run away, they experience a sense of closure. When people are forced to submit to overwhelming power, as is the case with abuse, domestic violence, and incarceration, they often come away from it with a sense of resigned compliance. The best way to overcome this submission is to restore the physical ability to engage and defend oneself. Of the author's favorite body-oriented ways to achieve this is a local impact center's model mugging program, in which victims are taught to actively fight off a simulated attack. The program started in Oakland, California, in 1971 after a woman with a fifth-degree black belt in karate was raped. Wondering how this could have happened to someone who she could supposedly kill with her bare hands, the conclusion that she had become neutered by fear. Her executive functions, her frontal lobes, went offline, and she froze. The body responds to extreme experiences by secreting stress hormones, which were originally meant to give us the strength and endurance to respond to extraordinary conditions. When people actively do something to deal with a disaster, rescuing loved ones or strangers, transporting people to a hospital, being part of a medical team, they utilize their stress hormones for their proper purpose and therefore are at much lower risk of becoming traumatized. However, even the best prepared person may become overwhelmed by the magnitude of their circumstances. Helplessness and immobilization keep people from utilizing their stress hormones. Once patients are able to confront their trauma-based physical experiences, they are likely to discover powerful physical impulses like hitting, pushing, or running that arose during the trauma but were suppressed in order to survive. These impulses can manifest themselves in subtle body movements such as twisting, turning, or backing away. Amplifying these movements and experimenting with ways to modify them begins the process of bringing the incomplete, trauma-related action tendencies to completion, which can eventually lead to resolution of the trauma. One of the author's patients, a college student with a history of unrelenting child abuse, took the course. When he first met her, she was collapsed, depressed, and overly compliant. 3 months later, during her graduation ceremony, she successfully fought off a male attacker who ended up lying on the floor. 6. Writing to yourself. One of the most effective ways to access your inner world of emotions is through writing, specifically in cases where victims of trauma lose their facility of language when it comes to self-expression. When you write to yourself, you don't have to worry about other people's judgment, you just listen to your own thoughts and let their flow take over. When you reread them later, you will discover surprising truths. In the practice called free writing, you can use any object as your own personal Rorschach test for entering a stream of associations. Simply write the first thing that comes to your mind as you look at the object in front of you and then keep going without stopping, rereading, or editing. The teapot that's been passed down for generations may remind you of loved ones you've lost or family holidays that were a mix of love and strife. Soon an image will emerge, then a memory, and then a paragraph to record it. Whatever shows up on the paper will be a manifestation of associations that are uniquely yours. The first systematic test of the power of language to relieve trauma was done in 1986, when James Pennebaker at the University of Texas in Austin turned his introductory psychology class into an experimental laboratory. He began by asking each student to identify a deeply stressful or traumatic experience. He then divided the class into three groups. The first would write about what was currently going on in their lives. The second would write about the details of the trauma. The third would recount their feelings and emotions about the event, and what impact they thought this event had on their lives. Many students revealed secrets that they had never told anyone. Of the 200 participants, 65 wrote about a childhood trauma. Although the death of a family member was the most frequent topic, 22% of the women and 10% of the men reported sexual trauma prior to the age of 17. The researchers were surprised how often the students reported histories of major and minor health problems. Those who reported a traumatic sexual experience in childhood had been hospitalized an average of 1.7 days in the previous year, almost twice the average rate. The group that had written about both the facts and the emotions related to their trauma had a 50% drop in doctor visits compared with the other two groups. Writing about their deepest thoughts and feelings about traumas had improved their mood and physical health. When the students themselves were asked to assess the study, they focused on how it had increased their self-understanding. Choosing a professional therapist. Training to be a competent trauma therapist involves learning about the impact of trauma, abuse, and neglect and mastering a variety of techniques that can help to calm patients down, lay traumatic memories and reenactments to rest, and reconnect patients with their loved ones. When it comes to trauma, no single treatment fits all. A dedicated therapist must be open to exploring options apart from the ones they can offer. It's vitally important for the traumatized person to feel safe with their therapist. This is a necessary condition for the victim to confront their fears and anxieties. In the author's experience, patients only get better when they develop deep positive feelings for their therapists. The critical question is, do you feel that your therapist is curious to find out who you are and what you need? Are you just a list of symptoms on a questionnaire, or does your therapist take the time to find out why you do what you do and think what you think? Therapy is a collaborative process, a mutual exploration of yourself. Letting go of the past, EMDR. David, a middle-aged contractor, came to see a therapist, the author, because his violent rage attacks were making his home a living hell. When he was 23 and working as a lifeguard, his left eye was taken out with a broken beer bottle by a group of boys who attacked him after he had scolded them. 30 years later, he still had nightmares and flashbacks about the incident. He was merciless in his criticisms towards his teenage self and incapable of showing affection toward his wife. Deep inside, he felt that the tragic loss of his eye gave him permission to abuse other people. However, he hated the vengeful person he had become. During his second visit, the therapist introduced a procedure called eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, EMDR, a psychotherapy treatment originally designed to relieve the distress associated with traumatic memories on the brain level. He asked David to return to the details of his assault, bringing to mind the sounds and images of the attack, as well as the thoughts that had gone through his mind. He then asked David to follow his index finger as he moved it slowly back and forth about a foot from his remaining eye. Within seconds, a cascade of rage and terror surfaced, accompanied by vivid sensations of pain, blood running down his cheek, and realizing he couldn't see. Every few minutes, the therapist stopped and asked David to take a deep breath. He would ask him to pay attention to what was now on his mind, in this case, a fight he had had in school. He told him to stay with that memory. Other memories emerged in response. Each time David reported a new memory or sensation, the therapist urged him to observe what he was remembering and resumed the finger movements. By the end of his visit, David looked calmer and visibly relieved. He felt that the memory of the stabbing had lost its intensity. It was now something unpleasant that had happened a long time ago. On the third session, they dealt with the aftermath of the trauma, how he had used drugs for years to cope with his rage. With repetition of the EMDR sequences, still more memories arose. David remembered talking with a prison guard he knew about having his now-imprisoned attacker killed and then changing his mind. Remembering this decision was profoundly liberating for David. He had come to see himself as a monster, but realizing that he'd turned away from revenge put him back in touch with a more mindful, more generous side of himself. David realized he was treating his son the way he had felt toward his teenaged attackers and decided to ask him for forgiveness. At the fifth and final session, he reported that he was sleeping better and said that for the first time in his life he felt at peace. A year later, he called the therapist to report not only had he and his wife grown closer, but also that he laughed more and took real pleasure in his hobbies. Unlike conventional exposure treatment, EMDR spends very little time revisiting the original trauma. The trauma itself is the starting point, but the focus is on stimulating and opening up the associative process. Patients who received EMDR no longer experience the distinct imprints of the trauma. It had become a terrible story that had happened a long time ago. Desperate times pay off. Trauma constantly confronts us with our fragility and inhumanity, but it also confronts us with our extraordinary resilience. Despite their suffering, many patients have gone on to become loving partners and parents, exemplary teachers, nurses, scientists, and artists. Most instigators of great social change have an intimate personal knowledge of trauma. Read the life history of any visionary, and you will find insights and passions that came from facing devastation. The same is true of societies. Many of our most profound advances grew out of experiencing trauma, the abolition of slavery from the Civil War and Social Security in response to the Great Depression. Trauma is now our most urgent public health issue, and we have the knowledge necessary to respond effectively.
The choice is ours to act on what we know.
Whether you prefer to read or listen, we have something for you. Visit bestbookbriefings.com now for more summaries. Whether you prefer to read or listen, we have something for you. Visit bestbookbriefings.com now for more summaries.